Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to this week's Noetta podcast. Today's episode is the first in a four-part series called A Spy in Exile. The guest is someone who needs little introduction. But for those of you who don't know who Martin McGartland is, he's a former British agent who infiltrated the ranks of the IRA at the age of 19. Martin McGartland went on to become the IRA's intelligence officer, whilst passing information back to his special branch handlers on its activities, including shootings, bombings and murders. After his cover was blown in 1991, Martin escaped kidnapped, torture and death at the hands of the IRA. And despite moving to England under a new identity and living a new life, he again escaped murder after being shot 6 times outside his Whitley Bay home. Today he still lives under serious death threat. He's here to share his story and to talk about the workings of not only infiltrating the IRA, but also how MI5 and Special Branch betrayed him due to the serious threat on Martin's life. This has been recorded over a secure connection and his voice has been altered to protect his identity. Martin, you're very welcome to today's podcast.
You're welcome.
We'll start off about where you grew up in Northern Ireland, Martin. Ballymurphy was a staunchly Republican area that was under the control, more or less, of the Provisional IRA at that time. Would you say there was a respect for the IRA during that time?
Well, to be honest with you, I have always maintained that there was probably more respect for people who were actually born in advance of the actual troubles really kicking off. I was actually born, obviously, in 1970, so things were actually just really starting off at that point. But for me, I've been very, very sort of vocal about this. I never ever had any sort of respect or love or anything for the IRA. I mean, I always believed that they were just thugs and they were just obviously causing a lot of sort of hurt, harm, and they were terrorizing, obviously, their own communities. I mean, that was always my experience. And I mean, I have also always said that that was probably one of the main sort of reasons why I didn't have any issues about actually beginning to work for Special Branch. That was one of the main reasons. I mean, I had close friends who were so badly beaten. They were mutilated. They were left with life-changing serious injuries and disabilities. And to be honest with you, I mean, I know that they were probably involved in little bits of petty crime. Some of them weren't, but they got really, really, really badly beaten. Some of them were shot and others were just terrorized on a daily basis by IRA men who themselves were involved in crime and who themselves were involved in what I would regard is stuff that goes completely against what the IRA basically would have you believe is their cause. And obviously, they would like you to believe that they're completely pillars of the local community and stuff and all. I mean, and that wasn't my experience growing up in West Belfast.
I know you're saying that there was no respect on your part. Was there a fear?
Honestly, there's no doubt. I mean, I feared them. Everybody who lived in staunchly Republican areas were very, very, very frightened because they knew what they were capable of. You know, if anybody ever had the misfortune of actually coming into sort of like the contact or actually coming into under the radar of the local IRA, I mean, they would be living virtually like, you know, in total fear. And some people have actually, like, you know, been so frightened that they would actually leave Belfast. They'd probably maybe go somewhere else, maybe, I don't know, Antrim. A lot of people who I knew who lived in Belfast actually left and went to Antrim, because Antrim at that time in the 70s and 80s was more of a sort of like a, it was a mixed community. It was Protestant and Catholic. And people went there because they were fearing, they thought it would be safe living in Antrim. So, I mean, that's how frightened people were.
Tell me about you growing up in West Belfast. You weren't interested in joining the IRA, but were you involved in any type of criminal behaviour, petty crime?
I've always been very, very sort of clear. I mean, I was involved in petty crime as a kid. And I mean, I give loads of examples of things that I was involved in when I was a kid. I mean, from like selling stolen goods. I mean, I used to be friendly with a gang of people who were, I would say, probably maybe 10 years older than me. And they used to travel all around. And what they used to do was they used to go shoplifting. And they used to come back virtually with a bootload, sometimes maybe with a carload of stolen stuff that they'd shoplifted. And I actually used to sell it. And, you know, if they had, say, pairs of brand spanking new Levi jeans or, you know, I don't know, fancy light switches from like different like hardware, these big massive hardware stores and stuff. And all, I used to be able to sell the stuff like for half of the actual market price the shops were selling for. And I did that obviously for probably at least a year or two. And I mean, people used to be coming to me and saying, oh, you know, Marty, you know, I'm looking for a pair of jeans for my husband for his birthday or, you know, one of the kids for blah, blah, blah. And they used to come to me and you say to me, if you get them, come see me right away and I'll buy them. So I was involved in that. I also got arrested for a burglary of a, I think it was the local school. And when they broke into the local school, what happened was they took all the equipment out of it and stuff and all. I think it was in the early hours of the morning. And me and my friends had been told, oh, the school's open and stuff and all like that, you know, and all, you know, there's loads of stuff inside there and stuff and all. So we went in, we were taking all stuff out, like little silly things and all, like recorders and all stuff like that. And like stuff, I mean, there was nothing really left in the place they actually take, because obviously the people who robbed it actually virtually cleaned it out. But I got arrested for stuff like that. And I mean, there was all other bits and pieces too. I mean, I also got arrested for trying to actually rob a local postman. And, you know, I got arrested because the army actually seen me doing it. I was a little bit like out of control when I was a kid. I mean, but I mean, see, to be honest with you, Trish, and this is me not making excuses. I mean, growing up in the area where I came from, I mean, it was like dog eat dog. That was my perception of like how I actually believed that people actually like live from day to day. I mean, it was very naive, but when you're growing up in that sort of an environment, I mean, you know, obviously you do things. Obviously, you look back now and say, well, you know, I was stupid, and obviously it was quite really, really bad, and that you know, stuff that when I look back now, I think, well, you know, I wish I could turn back the clock. But obviously, another side of the story, another side of the coin, is to be honest with you, everything that I did do when I was younger, I think it actually like probably like, you know, made me, you know, a lot more sort of like streetwise, and it prepared me, you know, for the future. I.e., like, you know, I was somebody who could actually like, you know, I would say look after myself, like handle myself. I don't mean like fighting way or violent way. I mean, but if I ever thought I was in danger, I would always be the type of person who could actually like know I wouldn't actually, you know, be in sort of any serious danger.
So how did you view the RUC in the British Army then, Marty? I know how you viewed the IRA, but, you know, were you conflicted in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, if you grow up in an area where people are been told, oh, well, you know, you don't like the police, you don't speak to the police, you don't like the army, you don't speak to them, blah, blah, blah. I actually grew up with, like, my mum as an only parent. I mean, my dad, actually, my mum split up when I was quite, quite young. And my mum looked after all of us, obviously, virtually single-handedly. And she did a very, very good job because, I mean, at that time, she actually had a lot of things going on with other family issues relating to, like, her own obviously, family circle. And I mean, you know, my mum, although she was a Republican and came from a Republican family, I can honestly say, hand on my heart, that my mum never, ever, ever, and I can say this without any hesitation, never, ever, ever, I do not believe, ever told me, well, you know, you don't obviously like speak to the army or the police and you don't do this and that. Now, one thing I will say is, I mean, the raid at our house in the past and stuff and all like that, but I was very, very young. They didn't find anything. But the raid at our house, obviously, because of my mum's obviously Republican sort of like family, sort of like, you know, that's what they did. The army and the police used to search houses whenever they obviously believed that there may be something in those houses. And I would actually get really angry with the army and the police and stuff, and all like that when they did it. But to be honest with you, that was a spur of the moment type thing. But when I grew up, there was times in my life where I came into contact with the army and also the police. And to be honest with you, they actually helped me. Like, I mean, I don't mean in a sense where, like, you know, help me, you know, if I was involved in, like, anything to do with, like, crime or whatever. I'll give you an example. When I was a young kid, probably about 12, 13 or something like that, me and a couple of other friends used to go and take all of the beams, like wooden beams, joists, and flagstones out of the old tower blocks that were getting dismantled and getting obviously demolished in the area I lived. And what happened was when the army was out in foot patrol, because I was so small and because I was like so weak, I was trying to actually borrow flagstones actually along sand because the flagstones had been dug up and it was just a sand base. And one of the army guys, I'll never forget this, he actually put his rifle over his shoulder and he actually took the wheelbarrow and pushed it off the sand. So what I'm saying to you is, I looked at them just like as like, I knew obviously they weren't normal. And what I mean by normal was obviously they weren't there obviously like, you know, because obviously like they wanted to be there, or you know, they weren't there obviously because like it was normal to have army basically on your virtual doorstep. I mean, people who lived in, you know, I don't know, Manchester, people who lived in Birmingham, people who lived in London didn't have that. But to be honest with you, I mean, I never, ever, ever had an issue with it. I mean, they did cause me problems then. I mean, mentioned that again in the book, examples where they stopped me and stuff and all, and they took stuff out of cars. And I remember one occasion where one of the actual policemen actually damaged a light in a car and stuff and all like that when I was in and stuff and all like that. So they used to do to try and provoke, obviously, a reaction and stuff and all like that. But I can honestly say I didn't have any issues with them beyond if I get into some sort of like a off the cuff sort of or on the hoof sort of like, dispute with him. I used to give him both barrels, and I wasn't one bit shy, but I was very, very sort of like capable of like, you know, going, like, you know, having a good old sort of argument with him and stuff and all like that, and they didn't like it.
Martin, you mentioned your mum and your family there quite a lot. You also lost a sister at the age of 12. She was just 12, Catherine, and it was reported that she had fallen through a skylight in school. It must have been absolutely devastating for your family.
I was always led to believe that our Catherine had died just in a normal sort of like accident. And the story that I had always believed was that she was on a primary school, I think it was Fair Foster Primary School roof. And the story was that she was on there and somebody had written something on the roof, trying to make out that she was in a relationship with a local lad, and she was a bit embarrassed about this, and it was supposed to be that she got onto the roof and tried to rub this off, and when she was doing that, she actually slipped and fell through a skylight, and that resulted in her death. But that was the story I always believed, but only in recent years I began to read articles and newspapers to say that Kathy would have been linked with the Women's IRA, and, you know, there was stories, you know, going around to say that she was actually on active service on that roof on the day she actually died. It turns out that the Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams in particular, actually unveiled a plaque, I think it's in the Ballymurphy estate, and R. Catherine's name is actually on that plaque as a volunteer of the IRA who actually died while on active service.
What exactly does active service in the IRA entail for a 12-year-old girl?
Anybody who knows anything about Sinn Féin and anybody who knows anything about the IRA know that they're not stupid when it comes to PR. They're probably like experts on that field. And when I heard what they had actually did in regards to R. Kathy, I was shocked, but also confused. And the reason why I was confused for, they were admitting that a 12 or 13 year old kid, a child who they had virtually groomed, there's no other word for it, they had groomed a child actually into doing whatever they actually were asking her. And not just her, there was other people, there was other young girls and other young boys, probably younger than our Catherine, and maybe some perhaps a little bit older. But nevertheless, they could never have understood what they were getting involved in or what they were being asked to do. And the most shocking thing about it, is the fact that the people who was actually, using them and abusing them were actually people who would have been adults, people who probably had kids of their own, and people who actually knew that they were putting them in grave, grave danger. And I can't understand why the IRA, or in particular Gerry Adams, would want to be unveiling a plaque with a kid's name on that plaque. And I think there's probably other young kids on there too, around about the same age, or maybe a bit older. And I can't understand why they would want to actually publicize that. It is like really suicidal. I read a story about, I think it was about maybe within the last maybe 2 years or something. And that's how I became more and more aware of this. But to be honest with you, I mean, I cannot believe that nobody's ever actually really picked up on it and really done a little bit of more sort of research and a little bit more publicizing.
Has your family ever been told what Catherine was allegedly doing for the IRA on the day she died? Or has it just been described as active service, whatever that entails?
You know, I'm not joking you, and this is hand on my heart. I actually spoke to family members after I read these stories, and all, they know is what the IRA had told them. They confirmed, one, yes, she was in, like, a junior woman's IRA.
I'm sure your mum, like many mothers, would have sat you down and said, listen, I don't want you joining paramilitaries, I don't want you involved in crime. She'd already lost a daughter. Was that a conversation that ever happened?
Yeah, I mean, my mum, honestly, one thing I will say to you, I tried to get this across whenever I did the first book, 50 Dead Men Walking. My mum is one of the most strongest people I have ever met in my life. And I've always said that. And anybody who has read the book has always said to me, your mum comes across as such a crazy, wild, funny, sort of like energetic person. She would have known if any of us, any of her children, because I had a brother and also sister, another sister as well as Catherine, and she would have known if any of us was showing any sort of interest in like paramilitaries and stuff and all. I mean, to be honest with you, she also knew that I was actually like always getting sort of like, I was involved in like petty crime and stuff and all like that, and she knew that I hung about with other people who would never ever, even consider like been involved with the IRA and stuff and all like that, or the INLA for that matter. So I don't think that was something that she was ever like concerned about. So I don't think that was something that probably she would ever had any worries about.
So 16, you began giving information to the RUC, which was the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the Northern Ireland police force at that time. You didn't become an agent then?
No, I wasn't. The most important thing is, I wasn't actually sympathetic to, I wasn't a member of, and I wasn't in any way connected even to anybody in the IRA. I was completely like not interested in them. I didn't have any involvement with them at all. When I came into contact with this officer, Billy, unknown to me at that time, he was actually being directed by Special Branch. And it was they who were actually like guiding him and instructing him and pulling his strings to get him to try to get me to go meet them. And that's what actually ended up happening. But what I'm saying to you is that was obviously like when I was like 16, 17, probably more likely like, late 1996, early 1987, I mean, around then. But what I'm saying to you is, at that time, I wasn't involved with the IRA. In fact, the IRA, as I pointed out previously, like in like book and stuff and all like that, I mean, the IRA used to completely crucify me and other people who I knocked about with. And they used to basically like chase us with hammers, and they used to basically go to my mum's door and virtually try to get my mum to hand me over to them, because they thought I was involved in like antisocial behavior and stuff. So, I mean, I had a hatred for the IRA even at that stage.
You mentioned Billy there, Marty, and Billy is the RUC officer who was the bridge to you joining Special Branch, more or less, as an agent.
That's exactly what happened. And, you know, I'm not exaggerating when I say this. Billy was stopping me at least once or twice a week, sometimes even more. And what happened was, I'll never forget this, he kept stopping me, and it was the usual stuff. What's your name? I give him a name. What's my address? I give him my address. What's your date of birth? I give him a date of birth. Now, that isn't unusual to be stopped by the police or even the army in Ballymurphy. It's not unusual. It happens every day. But when you walk away and say, thank you very much, bye-bye, you walk away, to actually be stopped days later or even the next day by the same officer who I call Billy, yeah, to be asked, what's your name, what's your address, what's your date of birth? You think to yourself, is this guy either taking a piss, or is he genuinely got something wrong? And we can't remember. He stopped me. He stopped maybe hundreds of people. And I just, you know, I mean, he can't remember me. But when it happens the third time, the fourth time, now you think, hang on a minute, this just something's not right here. And I was getting very paranoid, because I knew that, you know, the area where I grew up, Ballymurphy, Moyart, I mean, the IRA, like, you know, they just virtually like walk around, like, you know, doing day-to-day things, like going to the shops or popping in to see what other neighbours, or driving to the shops. And they drive by and they see someone like me talking to the police. And they think, well, what's he talking to them? And then if they drive by another day and I'm talking to the police again, think, what's going on? So I was very, very paranoid, but I was really worried, because I thought to myself, people may think that I'm actually, like, you know, doing up to no good with these people. So I was, like, really getting a bit annoyed about getting stopped very often by this guy, who all I knew his name was Billy, Officer Billy, I called him.
1989, you officially became a Special Branch agent. What age were you then?
I was only 19. Years ago, I didn't really, I mean, when I done a program for the BBC way back in 1992, within a year of me actually leaving Northern Ireland, and they called that program The Informer. Now, at that time, you know, most people who do what I do are labeled as informers, or for people who are like Republican sort of sympathizers, or people who are in the IRA, were just known as just pure and simple touts. Now, one thing I want to mention is, right, at that time, whenever I actually did that program, I was happy to accept that label. But you know, as time went on and I actually started to tell my story more, it became clear to me that, you know, informer label, you know, I'm always going to be tarred with that for the rest of my life. It doesn't bother me. But really, when you look at my case in the cool light of day, yeah, I was somebody who was not before nor during my, obviously, going into the IRA, actually, you know, a committed member of it. I was actually working for Special Branch long before they actually encouraged me, because I didn't want to do it. They actually encouraged me to actually go inside the IRA, and I was extremely, extremely reluctant to do it. But what had happened was, right, I was in a position where I had been working for Special Branch for almost 2 years before, from at least 1987 up to 1989. And it was only around that period when they actually encouraged me to actually go inside the IRA as like an agent on their behalf. So what happened was, right, there's very, very few people. I mean, people probably don't really appreciate this, but there's very few people either in the Loyalist side or the Republican side who have been working for British intelligence, the Army, Special Branch, or whoever, who were actually not involved before they were either turned or they were actually recruited. 99.9% of people who become informers are already established, ruthless, either loyalist or Republican terrorists who are blackmailed into becoming informers because they don't want to go to prison. And that's the top and bottom of it. The difference between me and them is a huge gulf on some. And the reason why that is for is because it's simple as this. If you've got somebody who's a terrorist, who wants to be a terrorist, who's happy to be a terrorist, who's happy to do like killings, bombings, shootings, whatever, because that's what they want to do, yeah? If the police come along and say, we've got evidence, we're going to send you to prison for 15, 20 years, and they decide they don't want to go to prison, they will work for the police, they will work for MI5, but they will never be loyal to them. They will never be loyal to MI5 or the police, not like someone like me, because I was actually virtually like groomed. I mean, that's what happened. Special Branch actually recruited me at the age of 16, 17, and they virtually groomed me. They knew where they wanted me to be, and they actually basically like pointed me to do certain things, and they guided me to do certain things, and they knew probably even months before they physically actually recruited me, i.e. when I say months before, whenever they had Officer Billy keeping on stopping me, they knew it was a jigsaw and the parts were all going to be put together, and they knew what they wanted. They knew my future held even before I knew what they were up to.
We know a lot about your story, Marty, because, I mean, it's taken up so many newspaper articles. You've written two books. Your life was turned into a film, 50 Dead Men Walking. And going by what I've read and seen, it appears that it was nearly easy for you to infiltrate the IRA and claim those ranks.
Do you know what, Trish? I'm not joking you. Seriously. I was surprised by that. But you know what? And I'm not exaggerating when I say this. I keep on repeating the same phrase that I'm not exaggerating, but I'm really not. See, when I look back at the way things actually happened, and the way my life actually very quickly went from somebody who had been involved in petty crime, who the IRA despised, and I despised the IRA, to somebody who actually get into the position that I was in, I look back and think, how the fuck did that happen? But do you know what? The reason why it happened for was because Special Branch made it happen. Special Branch and MI5 know exactly who in the IRA are people who are most of interest to them. And it just so happened, and this is the surprising thing to me, when I actually got in with Special Branch, they were telling me that a person who I'd grown up with, now when I say grew up with this person, I just lived in the same area as him, but I used to be a friend of his with a number of other people when I was younger. And they were telling me, now I've named this person in the book continuously, Harry Fitzsimmons. Now they told me that Harry Fitzsimmons was a top IRA bomber. Now Harry Fitzsimmons has been in prison for a long time. I think he'd done 15 or 16 years for possession of explosives and weapons and stuff a lot, and he got released under the Friday Agreement. So I mean, he's actually like, I mean, it's in the book and stuff and all like that. And I mean, it's also in the public domain. But what they told me was that Harry Fitzsimmons and a few other people who I'd seen him in the presence of were top IRA bombers who were heavily involved in massive bomb attacks all over Belfast at that time. And I looked at them thinking, you know, you guys are obviously completely crazy, because I knew Harry Fitzsimmons obviously from old. Well, I thought I knew him. And it turned out later on that when I actually was asked to infiltrate the IRA, what the Special Branch had told me was they wanted me to actually try to get friendly again with Harry Fitzsimmons. And because I actually did do what they actually asked, and I was very successful at doing that, yeah, everything just started to like snowball after that. So they directed me towards Harry Fitzsimmons, and Harry Fitzsimmons, because he was senior in the IRA, instead of me climbing up the ladder, Harry Fitzsimmons was already halfway up the ladder, and he brought me into the people who he was mixing with.
It's extraordinary that you were able to infiltrate the IRA with that ease. Can you remember your first briefing that you got from Special Branch? I'm sure like everyone else, we all have these images of being taken into a darkened room with two men in suits and being recruited. What was the actual experience like for you?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, because I was the type of person who was very streetwise, and because I was the type of person who's always been very mischievous, and because I was the type of person who just didn't really give a fuck. I mean, that's the truth. I just didn't care. I mean, I was the type of person who happy-go-lucky, you know, and didn't care what I say, didn't care who offended if I thought somebody needed to be offended. And, you know, if I had made a decision to do something and I believed I was doing the right thing, there was nothing or any person on the planet who could actually, you know, prevent me from doing that. But when I actually got involved with Special Brunch, I only got involved with them as a result from Billy. Billy had said something to me, yeah, which really, really knocked me for six. He said to me on one of the final times, he stopped me before he asked me to go and see two of his friends. He said to me, I hear you're taking driving lessons. And I actually was taking driving lessons. And I didn't know how the fuck he knew this. And he said something along the lines to me. He said, listen, he says, I may be able to help you with that. I've got a couple of friends who'd be able to help you, you know, obviously, like you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
The driving test and stuff like that. Well, I always wanted to have a car. I mean, I've always, since I was very, very young, I always wanted to get a car and stuff like that. And what Billy had said to me was, right, he wanted me to go and meet two of his friends, yeah? And I had to go to Grosvenor Road, OUC station, which was quite a distance away from me. It was a taxi drive away and then a walk. Obviously, if about a mile or two, obviously, you know, well, at least a mile after you get off a taxi, like, you know, on the Falls Road. And what happened was I was going to this meeting to meet Billy's friends on the understanding that they were going to help me get a driving license. And that was the sort of like the bait that they were using something to actually entice me because they knew that I actually wanted a driving license. They knew, and I don't know how the fuck they knew this, that I was taking driving lessons, and they thought, right, and this is why I'm saying to you, like, notice, like, do you ever see a film called Truman Show? Honestly, my life, and probably, I would actually regard this as the same as all the loyalists and all the Republican terrorists. Special Branch, MI5, and the Army also too, everything that was happening in Northern Ireland, they knew roughly what was happening, who was involved, but they just didn't have all the parts of the jigsaw to be able to, you know, do what they would like to do, actually stop everything, you know, arrest everybody, blah, blah, blah. But honestly, they knew every fucking thing even back then. So long story short was, right, when I went to the first meetings with these people, yeah, they more or less told me, we can help you get a fucking driving license. That's what Special Branch told me. See, when they told me that, I thought, fucking Jesus Christ, how amazing. Because to be honest with you, I was worrying myself fucking sick about going for a driving test because I was thought, oh, you know, I'm going to fail because I'm going to be around nervous, or I'm going to fail because I'm not good enough or whatever. But they convinced me that they were going to help me get a driving license.
And did they help you get a driving license, or was that a ruse?
Well, the reason why I'm laughing for was because when I went, they were telling me, oh, you know, we're going to get you a driving. They were even telling me, oh, they knew the name of the person who was going to take me my driving tests and stuff and all. I'm sure from memory, it was somebody called Cunningham. I mean, don't quote me, but I'm sure they say it was someone called Cunningham. And I went from a fucking driving test thinking, right, I just have to get in this car. I just have to drive. He's going to hand me a bit of paper and I'll say, thank you very much, walk away. I went from a fucking driving test. There was no Mr. fucking Cunningham. And when I went back to Special Branch, he says, oh, he was on his day off. It was all a lot of balls, Trish. It was all a lot of balls. What they were doing was, they were hoping I just went and passed my fucking test, and they would have winked at me and says, I told you well enough.
Looking back now, do you feel that you were groomed by the RUC and Special Branch?
No doubt about it. And I'll tell you another thing too. And I've only came to this realisation in the past couple of years, and it really saddens me to say this, but I now regret. And I, honest to God, if you'd have told me that I was going to say these words to you now in an interview that I'm about to say, I would have just said to you, you're fucking absolutely crazy. Definitely not. But I'm telling you here and now that because of what I have actually found out over the last couple of years, and because of the way I've been treated during the past, say, 20 years, yeah, more so over the past 4 or 5 years, right, I really, really, really regret ever becoming involved with a Special Branch at MI5. But one thing I will say, and I mean, I spoke a great deal about an RUC handler in the book called Felix. Now, one thing I'll say to you now, yeah, in my mind, he and other people like him in the Special Branch were, and some people won't be able to accept this, but I don't give two fiddlers fucks. I'm speaking to you as honest as I possibly can be, yes, right? Them people saved thousands of people's lives. I don't just mean Felix, and I don't just mean the people who dealt with me. I mean the good guys in the Special Branch, because there were good guys, really good guys. But you know what happened? MI5 came along, and when they decided that Marty is going to be no more, or Marty has outlived his usefulness, or Ray Gilmore has outlived his usefulness, or Willie Carden has outlived his usefulness, or Dennis Donaldson has outlived his usefulness, except, they decide that, you know, they're going to pull the rug from under you, and they don't give a fuck if it means you're going to either be kidnapped, you're going to be tortured to death, and you're going to be murdered. They don't give two fiddlers fucks, because they want to move on to the next Marty, they want to move on to the next Ray Gilmore, they want to move on to the next Willie Carland and Kevin Fulton, etc. And that's what they do. They are absolutely devious cunts, but not the handlers. The handlers are just doing their job. It's their fucking bosses. Their bosses are absolutely fucking devious, rotten, horrible fucking people.
So it's clear that you have good words to say on your individual handlers who, at that time, made you feel safe and protected. You would need to have been made to feel safe and protected because the levels that you were operating at within the IRA as an agent were serious. you started off in security in the IRA before moving on to become a lieutenant within its Belfast intelligence unit. What did that involve?
Special Branch had me on my own going into the heart of Republican areas, going to IRA weapons and explosive dumps, taking out IRA weapons and explosives and ammunition, bringing them back to meet Special Branch. We all travelled back to Castlereagh. We were sitting around waiting while the MI5 and the Army and other specialist people did what they were doing. And what I presume, what I mean by that was, they were actually, the weapons that I brought to them from an IRA dump, they were carrying out ballistic tests on their weapons to see how many people have been used, if any, to be killed previously. So if they've ever been used in shootings previously. They also actually, neutralized the explosives. They could neutralize explosives. I was told they were injecting it with a chemical, and Sandpack's explosives was virtually fucking like, it was like putty. It wasn't like, it would never blow up. They tampered and they sabotaged detonators, so they're never going to blow up. And they actually even doctored weapons and bugged weapons, so they could put a bug on a weapon, maybe a rifle or something, or do something with it. So when I put it back in the dump, when it moved away from me to another IRA dump, they moved the stuff and they watched it going from A to B to C, and then they would have went and they would have recovered it and arrested people. But what I'm saying to you is, when I look back at what I did and what they expected me to fucking do, I think to myself, you must have been absolutely fucking living in a completely different fucking planet, because the stuff that I done, I was walking through fucking streets in the dark at night, in the early hours of the morning, with whole dolls full of weapons and explosives to take at the Special Branch and MI5 to be doctored and all them other things that I just told you there to be done with it, right? And then I had to bring it all back again. And sometimes the Special Branch used to actually fucking pull little pranks on me and stuff. And I'll give you an example of this. They thought it was funny, but I really, really panicked. One of the IRA bombs that I brought the Special Branch, it was an undercar booby trap. And what the IRA did with it was, When they constructed the same tax bombs, it was a small, they called it a charge of same tax, 1.5 pounds of same tax. And what they done was they actually implanted a magnet in the same tax. And what happened was it had like a small wooden sort of box on the actual device with a timing device and also a mercury kill switch inside it and all the electronics. But what they did was, because when they put it under a car, what they done was they covered it with black tape, insulation tape. So when somebody looked under their car, they prayed that they might have thought it looked like just the underside of the car. Because obviously Semtex is like an orangey, sort of like a yellowy colored, substance. And all this black tape and, obviously like was all covered in the bomb. And when they gave it back to me after I went into fucking Castlereagh for it, one of the wires or something, there was a very distinctive wire. And also tape. And what they used to fucking do was they used to change the colours of the wires and the tape. And they'll say, oh, Marty, we're very sorry that wire fell off. Or, you know, we didn't have enough black fucking tape. And they may put green tape on or yellow tape on her. And I used to be beside myself, but they thought it was fucking funny. And it was all like, that was all they thought. It was a bit of humour. But fuck me, I was the one who had to go back with all this stuff to put it back in the IRA dump. And the person who constructed that, if they seen anything that didn't look right, then they think, well, how, you know, who's been tampering with this? And then people like me and other people would actually be fingered. So they used to be like a little bit sort of like fucking crazy Special Branch, the way they used to do things.
So you're telling me that you were going to IRA dumps, taking weapons, transporting bombs, taking them to Castlereagh, bringing them back again. I mean, apart from the obvious fear of being caught doing this by the IRA, were you not worried that they were going to go off?
Of course I was. Listen, look, you know, when I sit now, when I close my eyes now, yeah, when I close my eyes and I have that conversation with you, I think of Demolition Man, fucking basically, you know, a bomb disposal, fucking sort of like whatever. That's what I was actually being used as. I mean, that bomb could have went off prematurely and killed me. And no doubt if it had gone off, the newspapers the next day would have been, IRA man killed, terrorist blows himself up. No one would have ever known that I was actually fucking bringing the stuff, the special branch in MI5, to actually try to fucking prevent life being taken. And this is the whole point. This is the way they work. And I go back to what I say, the people who I work with, the people in special branch who were handling me, yeah, I haven't got a bad word to say about them people. Hand them hard. I'm wise enough to know that they're just doing their fucking job. It's like any employment. If you're a journalist and you have to work under the direction and control of an editor, a deputy editor, or people on up the fucking chain, if you begin a story that's toxic and they've got some reason why they don't want you to actually do that story, they will make your life a bit of a fucking sort of like misery, and they'll do things that obviously aren't, you know, to your benefit, stuff not like that.
Oh, so I know that.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm saying to you is, I know for a fact, in any other walk of life, like fucking somebody who's basically working for like a civil servant or something like that, they will not actually allow them to do something that goes contrary to what their main sort of motivation is. And what I'm saying to you is, right, the people who was harming me done their best. But what happened was, I mean, just to jump a bit forward and I'll come back. When Ian Phoenix died, he was killed in a Chinook helicopter crash. Ian Phoenix ran TCG, Task Coordination Group, yeah? And now they were involved in all the fucking surveillance and stuff and all like that, right? And what happened was, Ian Phoenix mentioned in his book, well, it was a bit mentioned in his diaries, yeah? He mentioned me, Carl, me, was one of the Special Branch's best spies. I think it was in 1990 or 1991. But what happened was, right, the reason why he fucking said that for was because he knew all the stuff that I had actually done. I was doing fucking everything that Special Branch asked me to do on some. I'm not the type of person who just basically does things half-hearted. I'm fucking all in. And what happens is when I go beyond the fucking call each and every time because I believed in what I was doing. But you know what? That was the reason why I ended up in the position I was, because I was doing fucking too much and I was more interested in pleasing Special Branch, pleasing MI5 than I was looking after my own fucking safety.
Your safety was in grave, grave danger for a number of reasons. You were in the heart of the IRA, working with highly skilled IRA officers, including Rosanna Brown, who's a well-known IRA member. You were in the IRA's active service unit, a position that is very, very hard to get and to climb to within the IRA. I mean, you must have been respected within the IRA to get to those positions and to work with those people.
It's nothing to do with being respected. It's more to do with, obviously, I honestly do think that they genuinely like me. I think what happens is if somebody takes a liking to you and if they actually think that you're like sort of like genuine and they think that they can trust you, there's no reason why anybody else couldn't do the same. I mean, other people have done what I did after me. And one thing I want to say to you here, and I mean on the subject of Rosanna Brown, I mean, you know, I actually, Rosanna Brown, I mean, and, you know, other people like, say, D.V. Adams too, I get on really, really well. And I mean, I've said this before. Davy Adams is a relative of Gerry Adams. Davy Adams is one of the most nicest people I've ever met in my life. Some people may say, fucking Jesus Christ, that's the top and bottom of it, right? And do you know what? That made me conflicted. Another reason why I got myself in so much shit for it, it was because I was trying to keep these people out of prison. I was arguing with Special Branch every other fucking month, telling them, if you arrest any of them in jail, I'm fucking stopping working for you. And I even said it once or twice that I was actually going to leave Northern Ireland and I wasn't going to work for them no more. And I really, really did. And no doubt that they would have sent that message back. And that was probably another reason why they fucking basically, like, you know, decided that, you know, whenever I was going to get, when I was going to be kidnapped, which we'll speak about later on, I think they thought, just leave him, let the con go on fucking rat and hell. What happened was, I was actually telling them that I wasn't happy that they were going to arrest people based on anything that I may information that I may have given against them. Because, you know, people may think this is a bit fucking crazy. But let me be frank with you here, right? The way I looked at it was, right, I done what I did, hand on heart, because I did never agree with any form of terrorism. I didn't then, I don't now, and I'll always go to my grave with the same sort of, like, principles. I don't believe in it. Nobody should actually have their life shortened, irrespective of whether a policeman, a British soldier, a civil servant, or somebody who they regard as a legitimate target, and I mean loyalists or Republicans, right? If I think someone's going to be, targeted tomorrow, and I thought I could do something, I would do it. And do you know what? The sad reality is, I would like to think that most other people would do the same thing. But, you know, to me, I was in a situation where I said to Special Branch, look, I am giving you information which is preventing things from happening. Be happy with that. Don't be putting me in fucking danger. Don't be doing things that are actually going to direct attention to me, bring me under suspicion. Because the minute that you arrest somebody, right, people are going to say, well, it must be him, or it may be her, and it could also be him. In an active service unit, you've only got a small group of people who can actually be suspects and people who could have passed on that information. So to me, Special Branch were a little bit reckless, like often. And I always said to them that I would not be happy for them to actually be arresting people, because I genuinely did. I actually, you know, I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if they had got arrested. But one other thing I'll say to you about this, naming, I know that the same people who I was trying to keep out of prison were fucking ruthless people who would shoot somebody as quick as they would look at them. But you know what? That's not my problem. That's their life. If they decided that they want to join the IRA, if they decided that they want to put their lives, in jeopardy and put their liberty in jeopardy, that's their fucking problem. Nothing to do with me. I've been asked to pass on information that's going to actually prevent, obviously, people been targeted, people been bombed, people been shot. And that's what I did. I didn't sign up for to be running around fucking getting every person who I come into contact with arrested and put in prison for 20 or 30 years, knowing full well that they've got families, and their families obviously arresting innocent people. I was very, very vocal to Special Branch, particularly about Harry Fitzsimmons. Harry Fitzsimmons had had two young kids and a wife, and people would go, oh, well, so fuck, he was involved in terrorism. Yes, he was involved in terrorism, but you know what? His family didn't have a choice. His family wouldn't have wanted him to be involved in terrorism. But the top and bottom of it is, they were the people who had to suffer when he and other people like him went to prison. And that's the reason why I couldn't actually, like, swallow the pill of actually me being in any way involved, directly or indirectly, than somebody probably ending up going to prison.
And that is one of the most fascinating and complex things about the position that you were in, because you were working with people that you probably liked, and to some extent, you maybe would have understood why they took the path they did. Was that something that you found hard to juggle?
Do you know what? And I mean this. People listening to this interview will be thinking, this guy is contradicting himself. And I'm going to say, no, I am not. And the reason why I'm saying that for is for this reason. I am absolutely pretty clear, right, that terrorism, whether it's the UVF, the USF, the NLA, or the IRA, or Al-Qaeda, whoever, yeah, I do not, in any shape or form, actually sympathize or, you know, in any way support, or I can't even bring myself to even, like, think, well, you know, maybe something happened to their families, and maybe, you know, somebody may have been shot or bombed, and they probably say that, well, that's their way of getting revenge or whatever. I can understand people's mindset wanting to do that. But for me, yeah, the top and bottom of it is, right, I wouldn't hurt a fucking fly like most other people. I'm one of these people, and I always was, not so much now, because obviously my mental health and my physical health are so bad, and have been for quite some time, where my life is completely, it's like a 360 reverse of what it used to be. But when I was actually there, I was the type of person where I was happy-go-lucky, always joking about, having a laugh. If I seen somebody who was getting, somebody who was in a little bit of, you know, they were having hard times, or somebody who was like in a bit of difficulty, I would be one of the first people to try and help them. And I mean, I could never, ever, ever imagine me ever been in a position where I actually could stay silent if I thought that somebody was going to go to bed on a Monday evening, waking up the next morning, give their wife a kiss and their kids a kiss, walk to their car, get into the car, and get blew to pieces. I couldn't do it. Right's right, wrong's wrong. Evil is evil. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, anybody who could, like, go to their bed at night knowing full well that they can sleep with, you know, the knowledge of they know that they've got information that would prevent somebody from actually, like, losing their life, and some mother losing a son, some sister losing a brother, etc. I couldn't do it, Trish. I just couldn't do it. And that's the reason why, actually, I was never conflicted. I didn't want them to go to prison, and I did everything I possibly could to make sure that it wasn't done in my name. But the special bunch had got other sort of, like, agendas. But as far as I was concerned, that probably put me in a far, far worse position, because I think the special bunch thought, we're not letting Martin McGarden dictate to us. And that's what I think happened. They probably thought, we're not letting him dictate to us. He works for us. We don't work for him.
You obviously became a problem for special branch. And I think it's obvious from this conversation why. How did you end up, or how did they nearly end up making you the sacrificed lamb?
I mean, it all goes back to what I mentioned to you about Ian Phoenix. The fact that Ian Phoenix, who was so senior, and he was in charge of TCG, obviously North, which is like all Belfast and stuff and all like that. The fact that someone like him actually mentioned me and spoke about me and spoke about operations that I had actually prevented speaks volumes. And I remember another thing too. John Ware, who worked for World in Action, Panorama, and Rough Justice, and many other national BBC sort of like television programs. He's a very, very well-respected and established sort of like journalist. I think he's an award-winning journalist. And John Ware had spoken to, because when he was doing a program on me back in 1992, John Ware actually went to speak to all his contacts. And he actually mentioned there's a newspaper article, I think from memory, I've got a copy of it, but I think it was The Independent. And John wrote an article, I think it was in 1997. And the reason why I wrote this article for was because, one, he had already done the story, The Informer, on me in 1992. And two, he'd done that article as a result of the court case back in 1997 that led to me being exposed, and later led to me being shot by the IRA on the mainland, which we'll speak to you about later on. But what John Ware said in there, and the reason why I mentioned this is significant, is because John Ware mentioned that he had actually been told by Brian Fitzsimons, who was the head of Special Branch. Brian Fitzsimons was later killed also in the Chinook helicopter crash with Ian Phoenix. And Brian Fitzsimons had told John Ware, and John Ware repeated this in that article, that Marty McGarden was a very productive agent. That is the problem. I actually did too much. I was too busy. I was basically all in. And the top and bottom of it was, I had two masters. One was MI5 and Special Branch, because the both of them were as one, and the other was the IRA. But at all times, from the very beginning, without hesitation or favour, I was always 100% completely loyal to Special Branch, MI5, on the state. And the reason why I was loyal to them for is because of my principles, and because, you know, the reason why I agreed to work for them for was because I despised terrorism, irrespective. If I had been a Protestant on the Shankill Road, I'd have been doing the same thing against the UVF and others. The top and bottom of it was, it just so happens that I was born on the other side of obviously the debate, and I was born brought up in a Republican sort of like area of Belfast rather than an Orange area of Belfast.
Tell me about some of the things that you were involved in with the IRA that Special Branch were fully aware of. Were you involved in punishment beatings? Were you involved in attacks? Were you involved in murder?
I was in a position where I actually, like, at the very start, I was actually been encouraged by Special Branch to actually make myself available to people who they were identifying to me. Now, what they were doing was, Special Branch were actually showing me montages. Because what you need to remember here is, Rick, at that stage, because I wasn't involved with the IRA, because I didn't really give two fiddlers about the IRA, because I wasn't actually, like, you know, interested in the IRA, the only people who I knew was in the IRA were people who were fucking terrorizing me and my friends. But apart from that, and when you go into the actual organization as a whole, I would have known very little or very few people who was connected with the IRA. And the Special Branch, what they were doing was, they were showing me photograph montages continually at every single meeting, showing me people who lived in the area where I actually, like, frequented. So I would have come into contact with these people, probably if it was passing them in the street or if it was, like, going to the shops or whatever, whatever. And it came to a stage where they had actually, you know, went over this so many times with these photographs, these montages. I actually got to know all these people virtually, like, off by heart. People who I'd never met before, people who I didn't even fucking know before. They actually said to me that if you get any opportunity, yeah, whatever it is, if they ask you for a lift because you're going to be driving a car, or if it's because maybe they might see you in a local club and they ask you to do them a favor, you do it. And you actually try to win their trust. And that's how I got into a position where people actually started to, they were coming to me. I wasn't really going to them. They were coming to me. And, you know, Special Branch again, what they done was, Special Branch had virtually mapped my entire lifespan from the minute they decided Billy was going to actually introduce himself to me, to ask me, oh, you know, we're going to help you for some driving lessons, you can go meet some of my friends, blah, blah, blah. From that moment, they had mapped out exactly what they knew they were going to actually ask me to do, how they were going to do it, and they knew everything. So by the time I actually went and I came into contact with some of these people who I knew were in the IRA, those people at that stage knew that I had a car, and people had cars, but obviously people, you know, like me, who was, like, living in areas in Ballymurphy at my age, you know, not a lot of people had cars, maybe families and stuff and all, maybe husband and wives who had jobs and blah, blah, blah. But I had a car, and Special Branch knew by me having that car, people would want me to actually, like, you know, do them favors. And that's how I become involved with people who was involved in punishment beatings. They asked me to drive them around, and I mentioned this in the book. And what they were doing was they were going around getting people who were, like, involved in antisocial behavior. Similar things to what I was involved, like, years before. And what they were doing was they were going around targeting these people. So I was actually being used as a driver. So to answer your question, yes, I was driving people around who I knew were in the IRA, who Special Branch asked me to actually, like, you know, transport them around, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, as well as that, yeah, it later transpired that I was also in a position where I was actually going to become involved in, you know, intelligence. You know, one of my main positions in the IRA was multi intelligence. So I was actually asked to go out by senior people in the IRA to actually, like, you know, do recces and gather intelligence on operations for, like, maybe shootings, bombings, undercar booby traps that were going to happen in the weeks to come or the months, obviously, you know, in the future.
You've explained quite a lot there, Marty, of what you were involved in, but to make it more direct, were you involved in murder within the IRA whilst under the control of Special Branch?
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.